I think that's kind of where NL leagues, NL only leagues are going to be won and lost this year, because people will definitely go and spend a lot of money on the top end and will avoid the bottom end, and have there were so many $1 players in NL labor. I think we counted them up, 40 $1 players. So that in the middle, if you've got a little bit of money saved up, you can make some hay. I mean, J.J. Hoover, for instance, is one of my closers. Got him for $2. Jeurys Familia was my other one for 15, which I think is a pretty good deal too. But you know, the Hoovers for two, Fernando Rodney for four, you know, things like that. That's where you can find a lot of the bargains. And the people that were able to do that, I think will do very well this year.
Done. Here's to us, November and the waning sun, and all the proofs I'd like to prove. We go down tonight.
Good evening, and welcome to episode 81 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. As you can hear by my voice, Brett Sayre is off tonight. I am your host, Mike Gianella, and with me is George Bissell. George, how you doing?
Hey, Mike. Doing great. It's weird not having Brett here, but we're going to have a lot of fun tonight. Looking forward to this one.
Yeah, we have a very special guest tonight, but before we get into that, I will just do the usual housekeeping. You can find us at baseballprospectus.com. On Twitter, I am Mike Gianella, G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. George is at George Bissell, also all one word, two S's and two L's. And our email is flagsflyforever@baseballprospectus.com. And please rate and review us at iTunes or at Stitcher. So before we go to break, I just do want to quickly introduce our special guest. He is Steve Gardner of USA Today and Sports Weekly. And we will talk to Steve in a moment as soon as we come back. Welcome back. And as I said before the break, we have the pleasure to be joined by Steve Gardner of USA Today and Sports Weekly. This past weekend, we're recording on Tuesday, this past weekend on Saturday and Sunday in Arizona, Steve headed up the labor, AL, and NL only auctions. As you guys remember, we participated in the mixed draft last month, and you know, this was auction weekend, which is very exciting, and it means that baseball's close. And just to kind of start out with, so Steve, you're in both leagues, right?
Yes, I am. That's how I keep tabs on everybody. Keep them in line.
That's a very, very commissioner-esque thing. And I have my recap of the AL. I wasn't in it, but I did write up the recap. My recap of the AL kind of noted for the most part that. And I've noticed this the last couple of years compared to the NL, it's a very, I don't want to say standard
auction.
It's certainly challenging, and the participants are challenging, and it's a difficult league, as all these expert leagues are. But right, there weren't a lot of twists and turns. Would you say that's fairly accurate?
Yeah, generally, I think the AL goes a little bit more according to plan. There aren't wild strategies that you see because of the participants in the NL. We even had Lar Michaels move from the NL to the AL, not to try and give it a little more flavor and excitement or anything, but just because that's how it worked out. But the AL tends to be kind of a by the book. And I think for fantasy owners that look at it, it's probably a good thing for them, just because you don't want to get anything too crazy or wacky, because you want to use the results and the auction values to help you prepare for your draft.
Yeah, and I made that point. And, you know, in terms of draft prep, I'm in an AL home league. It's a 4x4. It's very old school. It's older. The league is older than George, but it is a great preparation. It's a great tool to look at in terms of preparing. One thing you pointed out in your article, which is at USA Today, some years in the American League, there's a not very many DHs. But this year, there were, I don't remember how many there were. There were eight or nine players who were DH only. And I believe it was Evan Gattis who was the second player thrown out altogether. Mm-hmm. And he went for 12. So I kind of wanted to ask you, you know, two questions as far as that goes. What did you think of those prices? And how do you prepare for an auction like that where there are a lot of designated hitters?
Actually, I don't know that we've ever seen a designated hitter crop as extensive and as good as the one that we have this year in the AL. So I don't know that there was any one way to prepare for it. The one thing I thought is that you treat it like a scarcity issue, in that, you know, a lot of times ways that you get your opponents to kind of spend their money, you throw out players that you don't want and you try and get them to spend. If you threw out a DH, for instance, and Gattis was one of those, you know, probably wasn't very popular among the eight, the big eight, we'll say, but you throw him out there and all of a sudden whoever gets Evan Gattis, somebody's got to get him, and whoever does, their DH spot is locked up. So you have basically narrowed it down to 11 owners that are now competing for the rest of the DHs, and so on and so on. So I think it's one of those, you kind of force the market and you force people to react to scarcity. And as a result, I think the prices were maybe a little bit lower on those DHs as a group than they might have been had there only been, you know, one or two.
Yeah, and something that tied into that I noticed that you didn't mention in your article, I felt that the DH prices or the glut of DHs pushed the first base prices down, because a lot of first base eligible players wind up DHing. So you have where a guy isn't eligible DH, you have a guy eligible first. I found a couple guys, Adam Lynn was an example, you know, someone younger like AJ Reed, even Logan Morrison, who, you know, we kind of laugh at him in mixed leagues. He isn't someone you consider. But if you look at what he earned in an AL only, particularly with those steals, he has some values, but I believe he went for three. So there mm-hmm. were just a lot of first basemen like that to me that kind of slipped through.
Well, I think the top end still, you know, Jose Abreu still went for 30. Edwin Encarnacion went for 30. Miguel Cabrera, 36. I mean, you still get the top end guys going for a substantial amount. Albert Pujols was probably one of the better bargains at 19. But I don't know. I don't know that it was too tremendous of a value on those first base guys. I may kind of disagree with you there a little bit, Mike. That I don't know that it played that much of a factor, unless, you know, Prince Fielder ends up playing 20 games at first base, or Kendrys Morales or Victor Martinez.
That's a good point about the eligibility, and I know in Towers, for example, which, you know, is the other expert auction, it's a 15-game requirement, so Fielder's first base eligible already, and it does change the composition a little bit.
I'll just throw in for in-season, it's 5 games played in labor to get eligibility out of position. So that could possibly, you know, Miguel Sano will certainly get eligibility in the outfield probably the first week of the season.
Right, that's a good point. So closers, I thought the closers would go for a little more money, just because some elite closers, as you pointed out, moved over. They can produce a lot of value, not just in strikeouts, but in ERA and in WHIP. And for the most part, you know, some of the prices, they certainly weren't cheap. And I know some of this is a hallmark of expert leagues. But I felt like, you know, looking at David Robertson at 14... we know why Aroldis Chapman fell. It's because of the suspension. That's not really a mm-hmm. surprise. But Ken Giles at 14 was another one. And I know he could lose some opportunities to Luke Gregerson. But overall, I you know, you mentioned the NL before, and we'll get to this. The NL seems like more of the place where closer prices have fallen. I didn't expect to see it in the AL. Were you surprised by that?
Well, I think the issue of supply and demand was out there, to where, you know, you had so many of them. So many teams have a relatively safe number one closer. And, you know, the Yankees probably one of the most influx right now. But for the most part, there were, I think, like 6 closers came over from the National League in the offseason. That's a tremendous number. I don't know that we've ever seen that many before. And as it, you know, added on to the number of closers, I think people, in the early going, maybe especially now, Wade Davis at 21, Craig Kimbrell 21, I think they kind of went for close to full value. But I think people felt like, oh, okay, well, I'm bidding on Cody Allen, and the price is getting up there and into the upper teens. I'll just pass, and I'll wait for somebody else to come along, you know, later on. You know, I'll wait for a Brad Boxberger or Sean Tolleson or Drew Storen or something like that. And I think that it kind of just got to be nice and comfortable that there were so many of them that it drove the prices in general down on all that group.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned that as a possibility as well, and that does make a lot of sense. So another part of that section were the catchers, and I believe, you know, Matt Wieters went for 17, and was that to Eno Saris of Fangraphs?
Yes.
I think that was, you know, and I think I saw Eno in his article today kind of regretted that, and the reason he regretted it is because so many catchers, they weren't cheap exactly, but there are some years in an only where with a two catcher league, and we'll talk about this in the NL, where the catching prices get pushed up. These prices were fair and maybe even a couple of bargains. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, the bar, when it was set with Wieters, I think Wieters might have been the first catcher out there. And generally, you want to set the bar with the best players at the position. And when Salvador Perez goes for 16 and Brian McCann goes for 15, then you start opening some eyes, and I think you know that's where Eno's buyer's remorse came from. And there aren't that many good catchers in either league, really. I mean, there are a handful of decent ones in the American League, but when you're in a two catcher league, it's just so tempting to, you know, maybe spend a little bit on one and just punt the other and play, you know, free agent pickup and free agent roulette and try and find a guy who will play every day. And I think, too, another thing with catchers is a lot of times you just get one that you hope doesn't do any harm to you. So, yeah, I thought the prices there were, you know, they were okay, but certainly they were affected by the fact that Wieters went out early at 17.
Yeah, and I didn't think anybody really, you know, I'm looking at the sheet now and I'm about to segue to your team, and I didn't really see anybody who, you know, jumped out as a big stretch. So speaking of that segue, first of all, and I should have said this up front, you know, in the AL, congratulations on winning last year. You had a really, you know, nice team and you did a nice job. And if I remember correctly, it might not have been wire to wire, but I know the NL was close and there were a couple of you know, people competing, but you held on for a pretty clear win.
Yeah. In the interest of journalistic disclosure. Yes. I jumped out to a quick lead, had the lead for all but 2 weeks in June, I think, when Tim Heaney took over, and then took it back. And really it was comfortable enough that I wasn't sweating it the last, you know, couple weeks of the season. So it was nice. I thank Chris Sale. I thank Lorenzo Cain and a handful of others last year that and Miguel Sano in the reserve round, I think, kind of propelled me to victory.
Yeah, those picks always help. So I'm looking at your team, and it looks like your big buy was Jose Bautista at 30, and on the pitching side, it was David Price at 29. When you go in to these auctions, you know, I know some people, and I really want to pick your mind on this because this is a big topic of discussion, and you're certainly one of the better auctioners out there. You know, I auctioned against you in Tout Wars. You have a good method. Do you have a hitting pitching split in mind when you start, or do you not worry about that?
I have a general hitting pitching split, and it's usually somewhere in that, you know, 67, 68 versus 33, 32, somewhere in there. A little bit more on the pitching side than 60-30, just because I think that's – if people tend to go overboard, they go overboard on the hitting side. And I feel like – and I'm not wedded to those numbers by any means. It just seems like I typically go a little bit heavier into pitching, at least these last few years, just because there are so many good pitchers and you need better numbers – to get, you know, some of the same standings points you might have gotten in previous years with lesser stats.
Yeah, and I found that too, particularly with the strikeouts. You can get caught if you spend 50 or 60 on pitching, you can get caught at the bottom in that category, and then it makes it hard in ERA and WHIP. But it's particularly true in an only format where the free agent pool is just brutal, and particularly with labor, where there are six reserve slots, and you know you can't, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, but you can't reserve a pitcher that you paid for at auction if he's still active.
No, that is correct, and that's one of the odd quirks of the labor reserve rules. It's if he's in a major league lineup and you paid for him at the auction, and he's got to be in your lineup. So, if you know, a guy is struggling terribly and getting shelled in consecutive starts, it's not like you can just park him on the bench until he gets out of it, or you know, stream by who he's matched up against that particular week. You know, I think the philosophy is you pick the guy and you have to stick with him through thick and thin.
Yeah, and looking at your pitching, you have, I mentioned Price, you have Carlos Carrasco, who I know a lot of people are really high on this year at 24. But then you back those guys up. Like, I like your bullpen. I like the combination of potential closers and well, I should say closers, really, and Sean Doolittle and Drew Storen at a combined 20. But then on the back end, you've just got some pitchers like Rick Porcello, who very quietly put up a good second half. Tyler Duffy, who I know some people don't believe in, but the numbers were there. You know, rather than put thoughts into your mouth, I'm just kind of curious as to what you think of this staff in terms of its potential, and you know, if you also see it as a strength.
Well, that was the important thing, and I got my two stud aces early in Price and Carrasco. May have, you know, I guess I didn't wait for the market to kind of develop. I went ahead and paid what was pretty close to full value for Price. He was the second most expensive behind Chris Sale, who was 33, I believe. And then Carrasco, I was really surprised that the bidding stopped at 24. And so I wasn't really expecting to get him, but I didn't want somebody to get a really good price on a guy that I think certainly has the potential to have a huge breakout season. So once I had those two guys, then it pretty much was, all right, you've got to get closers, you got to get saved somewhere. And then beyond that, I mean, I've already spent a good chunk of my budget on those two, you know, those two arms right there, $53. And you've got to fill in with bargains and not, you know, have to resist the temptation to go after, you know, a good pitcher who's at $12 just because he's a bargain. You know, you've got to have some restraint there because you've also got to get hitters. And so, you know, I think at least toward the end of the draft, it was a little, you know, dicey about whether I'd be able to get some of those guys. And as it turned out, I liked the staff. I may have paid a little bit more than I should have for Eovaldi, but again, I think there's still some room for growth for him. So yeah, in the end, I'm pretty happy with my staff just because I think they were undervalued for the kind of talent that they can, you know, that they have and the stats that they can provide.
It definitely looks to me like the strength of your team, just you know, Price is rock solid. You know, Sale, you mentioned, I think in terms of floor, though, Price might actually, you know, have the higher floor. Looking at your hitting, you know, I'm kind of looking up and down at your team, and I mentioned Batista. It's, you know, when you spend close to 100 on pitching, so your hitting's not thin exactly, but it is probably outside of Batista and maybe Hosmer, who isn't a traditional big bopper at first, but certainly provides the stats.
Right.
It seems like you have a lot of guys, and I like these kind of players, like Omar Infante and Jed Lowrie and Kurt Suzuki. They're not exciting players, but they, if they're playing, they will produce stats in an only.
Yep. And that's the thing, you know, that's the price that I paid, no pun intended, for going heavy on those two pitchers, is that, you know, and I had Batista was the first guy that I rostered, and I wanted to get, you know, power, RBIs, and, you know, have that kind of an anchor that I knew was going to, you know, be in the one of the better offenses in all of baseball. But then to fill in around, it wasn't really that easy, and I got a couple of good bargains. I thought Ian Kinsler at 19 was a good bargain at second base. Victor Martinez later, as the DHs started coming off the board at 12, I think the Tigers are going to have a very solid offense, you know, maybe rival the Blue Jays in terms of putting together a decent amount of runs scored. And then, you know, after that, it was just a matter of trying to fit guys in. And, you know, in an only league, you're not going to get stars at every position. You've got to have some of those role players and those, you know, inside of $5 guys. And that's where, you know, Suzuki lands on my roster. Jed Lowry lands on for $3. Not a bad deal. Infante for $1. So those guys, you know, kind of fill things out. And if they play every day, then I think I'm in great shape.
Yeah, and to kind of close out on the AL and your team, you on the other hand, you took some players like Joey Gallo and Dalton Pompey and Nomar Mazara. And to me, there's the balance there. You do have to take those grinders. I also think you have to take at least one or two of those upside guys. I know last year in Tout Wars for me, that was Addison Russell and Noah Syndergaard, who were two players with talent, but people like, where are they going to fit in? And if one of those guys hits, it really gives you a boost.
Yep. And like I said, Miguel Sano last year, I don't know that anybody, you know, was really expecting him to come and make the major leagues. But he certainly did. And that boost as a reserve pick was just huge for my team.
Yeah. So I never know where to start with the National League. So the you know where I'm, you kind of mentioned this in your piece, but the first thing is for the last couple of years, the prices on the top players have been pretty low, and, you know, relative in particular to some of the other expert auction leagues. But this year, I think it was Derek Van Riper of RotoWire. He just started out with a boom, and it wasn't early because there was some spread between the two players, but he picked up Paul Goldschmidt and Bryce Harper for 40 apiece, correct?
Yes, he did.
Now, were you expecting that, or were you based on the fact that the National League is a little bit thinner? There's some teams that are rebuilding or tanking, depending on, you know, what you want to call it. Or were you surprised by that?
No, I was fully expecting both Harper and Goldschmidt to hit 40, maybe even above that, just because, as you mentioned, there are a lot of really good players, but because you've got two teams in each division in the National League, a total of six that are in the process of rebuilding, you've got, number one, you've got pitchers that are untested that are on the mound for those teams, and you've got playing time situations and job competitions that are unsettled, and we don't know, you know, who's going to win the left field job in Cincinnati or something like that. So it makes for a definite stars and scrubs setup for maybe, depending on the personalities of the owners in your league, for just about everybody, because there are lots of very good players who are going to feast on, you know, inferior competition, and there are going to be a lot of questionable players who may or may not get playing time down at the bottom. And so you have to make a choice. You can go that stars and scrubs route, or you can try and avoid the dregs of the player pool and try and stay out of that. And because, you know, the NL has traditionally been very unpredictable anyway, we got an even, you know, even bigger dose of all of that.
Yeah. So it does make me wonder, you know, with someone like Goldschmidt in a week and a half at Tout, you know, in an OBP league, he went for 40 in labor and he has more value there, you know, how much he's going to possibly climb to.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised to see him, you know, in that $45 range.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking too. So on the pitching side, and this is where, so last year in Tout, I'm sorry, last year in labor, 29% of the budget total was spent on pitching. And this year, that trend continued. And part of the reason that happened is there was not one, but two owners. They didn't tank pitching. They didn't go the old Labadini $9 pitching strategy, but they did go pretty cheap. I think they each spent about $35 per roster, give or take a dollar or two each way. We've seen Doug Dennis of Baseball HQ do that before, but the other participant was Steve Moore of Inside Edge. When did you notice this like happening, and did you do anything during, or were you able to do anything to combat it, or by that point was it too late?
Yeah, I think that's one of those where you can realize it, but because of the the player pool, there's not a whole lot you can do. I mean, most people in the room knew that Doug always goes fairly inexpensive on his pitching staff and then loads up in the reserve rounds and tries to play, you know, matchups and use bullpen guys to improve ratios and things like that. So we knew that the pitching prices were probably going to be, you know, if he's not bidding, then the pitchers would probably be a bit depressed in terms of total value. So once, and Steve Moyer was sitting to my left. So once, you know, we start looking at the board and he doesn't have any pitchers and he's not bidding on any. And it was okay. Well, let's see now, what can we do? I went for a couple of ace type pitchers in Madison Bumgarner and Zach Greinke. Again, I don't know if that was, you know, a happenstance or just seemed to work out that way, but same sort of thing that I did in the AL is get a couple of pitchers and pretty close to the same prices too, at 29 and 25, and just build from there. The difference for me though is that because the mid-tier of starting pitchers, if I was willing to go maybe into double digits and I did on Michael Wacha at 14 and get a third, you know, top level type starting pitcher, those were available, whereas they weren't necessarily available with everybody bidding in the AL. So again, I spent close to $100 on pitching just because it was there for the taking. And really, you look at it, standings points in hitting and pitching both add up to the same number. So, you know, if it's there for the taking and the other guys aren't going after the wins and the strikeouts and the saves, might as well, you know, maybe push a little bit more money into that area and get some, you know, where you can.
Yeah, and you mentioned the middle, and this segues nicely. I was going to talk about the middle is really where the pricing dropped off. And in fact, the pricing at the top this year, so there were nine, actually, I have this sorted differently. So there were 10 pitchers this year in labor. Mm-hmm. In labor NL, I should say, who went for $25 or more. Yep, that's correct. There were 10. And last year there were three. if you expand it out, there were to 24 last year. In 2015, there were five. So, you know, you can say, okay, I'm quibbling. But there definitely was that willingness, and I think this is what you talked about with the tanking or rebuilding, or again, whatever you want to call it. That's going to be my new catchphrase. People were willing to really push on those guys at the top, I think, is the uncertainty at the bottom. But because only 29% of those budgets were going toward pitching, it did lead to some of those bargains in the middle.
Yep, it did. And I think that's kind of where NL leagues, NL-only leagues, are going to be won and lost this year, because people will definitely go and spend a lot of money on the top end and will avoid the bottom end and – there were so many $1 players in NL labor. I think we counted them up, and we may be off by one or two, but there were 40 $1 players in the auction. So that in the middle, if you've got a little bit of money saved up, you can make some hay. I mean, J.J. Hoover, for instance, is one of my closers. Got him for $2. Jeurys Familia was my other one for 15, which I think is a pretty good deal too. But, you know, the Hoovers for two, Fernando Rodney for four, you know, things like that. That's where you can find a lot of the bargains, and the people that were able to do that, I think will do very well this year. And, that's kind of what I tried to do with the second half of my draft, is not get caught into those $1 players and all the question marks there. It's at least try and get guys that are a little bit above the fray to where they're maybe a bit more predictable than the rest of them.
Yeah, and you mentioned the closers. It's really, you know, I talked about the AL, the closer price is slipping a little. Now in the NL, you had Kenley Jansen, who I believe went for 20, and Trevor mm-hmm. Rosenthal, I think, went for 18. And those prices, yep. I know in some home leagues, closers go for more, but for labor and for expert league history, that's fair. But right, Jeurys Familia, Mark Melancon dropped, and then all of a sudden at the bottom, there was this big tier, and I know some of these guys are shaky, but I agree with you, Steve. If you have a chance at a $2 closer, he could save 30 games, and I know that he could also blow up in a week or a month, but at $2, who cares?
Yeah, exactly right. And then, you know, that's one of those where I think in the National League, you can also kind of back up you get a weak closer, you can back him up with somebody in the reserve round or later on and possibly, you know, protect yourself as best you can and do that for a very low price. Like Jumbo Diaz was a reserve pick. So I got both of those guys. Now watch, you know, Tony Cingrani or somebody end up closing and getting 30 saves. But at least at this point, that looks like a pretty good pair.
Yeah, I think without a doubt, you know, that's something that I like to do. You know, one thing I found kind of intriguing, but I think this ties back to the fact that two teams tank saves. Sometimes when closers are that cheap, you can go for, you know, try to do like a three closer strategy, but mm-hmm. I don't think anybody did that.
No, I don't think so. I think the one that I would love to have gotten a piece of would have been the Giants, because I think they're obviously a very talented team. Santiago Casilla, okay. But if you could have gotten Hunter Strickland and then maybe Sergio Romo as a reserve round pick or something like that, that would have been a nice trio. But as it turned out, Strickland went for $9 because it was the final bid for whoever got him, and that was the end of their of their night. So it didn't work out that way.
Yeah. So to segue to your team, you mentioned some of the pitchers, and you know I have to say this is true in both leagues, but especially true in the National League. You have Bumgarner and Greinke. You have Familia. You have Waka. You have Vincent Velasquez, who we all agree, I think George does too, is just a terrific, well, he's probably a sleeper if you're in a mixed league. He's not a sleeper in an NL, but he's a name I think that's going to just shoot up the charts as people see him and remember him.
Love that strikeout rate, yeah.
Yeah, and then the velocity pops when, you know, he was on, I think it was yesterday, the velocity just pops when you watch him on the tube. But I love your staff. It just has, you know, the strong, you know, guys at the front. A lot of upside in Velasquez and Glasnow. It just really has the potential to kind of dominate the standings.
I hope so. And you know, when I was putting it together, the ratios were lower than even my targets were, so that was great. And it all depends. You know, I also drafted because we got into the, you know, close to dollar days. I got Homer Bailey for $2, I think, and Hyunjin Ryu for $3. And those guys, you know, if they come back healthy, will certainly provide that amount of value and probably a good deal more. So the problem then is just filling those spots. And Glasnow, you mentioned, you know, he'll probably start the season in the minor leagues. But if I can fill those pitching spots, boy, that's going to be, you know, a fantastic staff if everybody's out there. And again, you know, you can dominate pitching too. You know, it's possible to do that and ride that to, you know, a high place in the league and maybe even a title. So in this instance, I think with everything so, you know, up in the air and uncertain, that I felt like was my best route to getting a championship team.
Yeah, and I completely agree, and I've won with teams like that before that have, you know, 50, 55 points in pitching and, you know, maybe a little bit higher, you know, 35, 40 in hitting, which doesn't sound great, but in a competitive league and in a redraft league, like labor can be enough. Yep. So I guess that would be my question about your hitting. I kind of look at it. You have Yasmani Grandal, who it's too bad Brett isn't here because it's one of his favorites. you have Aaron Hill, who's another one of Brett's favorites. But you have, you know, Jason Hayward is your centerpiece. And I know some people don't like him this year. I think he'll be fine. But you don't really have a superstar. You kind of did the similar thing, and I think even more so, where you sort of spread the wealth and – you know, you also avoided, it looks like your lowest offensive player is $3. You kind of avoided the end game there. Was that deliberate, or was that just a product of the way the auction went?
It sort of was my game plan, in my game plan. And like I said earlier, you know, I just did not feel comfortable trying to speculate on all those guys who would be $1. I didn't think that there would be 40 $1 guys, but no, I wanted to get guys that at least had a bit of predictability on playing time, especially for those late roster spots. And, you know, the one thing to realize, I think anybody that has an NL-only auction or draft, is that when your team is put together, unless you're in a six-team league or an eight-team league, you know, a 12-team league, you're going to have holes no matter what. So as long as you recognize that going in and don't get worried about the fact that, oh my gosh, you know, Asdrubal Cabrera is my middle infielder, you know, or I'm relying on Tommy Pham to be a contributor in the outfield, and Brian Pena is my second catcher. You know, as long as you realize that you're not going to be able to put together a team that you really feel comfortable with coming out of the draft, it makes it a lot easier to kind of look at it and say, okay, I can go forward with this team. And it was funny because talking to everybody in that NL draft after it was over, it's like, man, I don't like my team. I'm not real thrilled with my team. But then when you look at everybody else's, you're like, okay, well, you know, my outfield isn't that great, but it's, you know, it's better than this guy's or that guy's. So it's really an exercise in trying to be, you know, at least content with your weaknesses and holes in your lineup.
Yeah, and to that end, it's a great point, Steve. And you know, I think we'll kind of close on this. And people really who play mixed leagues and especially standard mix, they look at NL, they kind of turn their nose down on it. Now, I remember when our mutual friend Scott Pianowski was in the NL, he used to write a column about it every year and kind of get bashed for in the comments of like, oh, this is the NL, it's ridiculous, you know, why'd you even bother to write about this? But there's a certain challenge to it, and that is part of the challenge. I like is trying to find the value. You know, somebody to mention on your team is Eric Ibar, who I constantly tout and the mixed leaguers roll my eyes at, but or their eyes at, but in this format, he's going to earn what you paid for him barring an injury.
Yeah, I mean, solid reliability. You know, he's an A, you know, A reliability if you know go by the Baseball HQ reliability scores. Asdrubal Cabrera, same sort of thing. And I'll throw one other thing out. I took a when I was at spring training, I was at the Brewers camp and took like a little video of Chris Carter, and you know he big swing in batting practice, and it goes doo, and it hits like the top of the batter's eye out in dead center field. And so I tweet that out and say, you know, there's why I paid $16 for Chris Carter in labor. And then people were responding that like, dude, Chris Carter's your first baseman and you paid that much? I was like, hey, calm down, folks. This is an NL only league. Chris Carter, you know, he may hit, you know, 205, but he's going to hit home runs, and power really, when you look at it, is scarce in NL only leagues.
And it certainly is. So before we go, well, first of all, again, Steve, thank you so much for coming on. We always appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. You're also in Arizona, so you're missing baseball or the opportunity to watch baseball to talk to us, which we really appreciate. Besides USA Today and Sports Weekly, can you tell us what else is going on and what we can look forward to?
Well, certainly you can check. I'm filing reports every day from spring training at the games that I see and players that I talk to, and you can see all those at fantasy.usatoday.com. That's part of our preseason coverage that we have, as well as on the newsstands right now. There's a USA Today Fantasy Sports special issue that's right there with the sports weeklies and everything else there, your grocery stores and convenience stores and everything. And that's our fantasy preview. It has the labor mixed draft, you know, that I'm sure is near and dear to your heart. So that's in there, and our fantasy rankings and everything. And then we have in the middle of March, March 23rd, coming out in the regular issue of Sports Weekly. It's the Fantasy Extra, known as the Leviathan, that has all the labor results and all the analysis from that. So a lot of great stuff cooking for us, and appreciate you having me on your podcast to tell everybody about it.
Thanks so much, and we'll and George will actually be there too. We'll see you in a week and a half in New York for Tout Wars.
I'm looking forward to it. Can't wait to see you there.
All right, Steve, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, guys.
All right, so this is reliever week at Baseball Prospectus, so we're going to kind of avoid what we've been doing. Everybody hates relievers. There's a lot of eye rolling. There's a lot of why do you have to have a category. But I did want to have a very quick roundtable, less about our tier rankings, which are up at Baseball Prospectus, and kind of have more of a philosophical discussion. We talked about this when Steve was on the air and about some of the bottom tier closers in an only. I wanted to talk a little bit more about mixed and other formats when it comes to relievers. So, George, this year we're really seeing a lot of unestablished closers, bullpens in flux, situations that we mentioned J.J. Hoover, there's Fernando Rodney, there's Will Smith. You can rattle off these guys. Maybe they'll get 30 saves, but maybe they'll lose the job in a month. How do you tend to approach this in your leagues? Does it make you more likely to go after a top closer earlier in your draft, or do you kind of keep the same discipline that you might have had otherwise?
Well, speaking in general terms, I mean, you mentioned it with the bottom rung, so to speak. I always look at closers as a bit like a ladder. There's that bottom sort of rung where, you know, they're just barely hanging on here. And some of these guys, you're right, they could turn into valuable sources of saves, but I don't think the ratios are going to be great in some cases. And there's a lot of question marks. We don't know who's going to close in certain situations. So I think they're all risky investments. I think there's such a high turnover rate with closers to begin with that I think it's worth it to go out and get an established guy. And one of the things that I actually had a conversation with Jeff Quinton the other day about relief pitchers, and there's a lot of hidden value there right now. And I look at two guys who stand out to me, Andrew Miller and Dellin Betances, because it feels like they're falling. Miller, his ADP is rising a little bit after the Chapman 30-game suspension. But Betances especially, I mean, it's hard to envision where the value is coming from when you draft a guy like that. So I think that's where you see the value coming in. Betances right now, he's going outside the top 200. And Jeff wrote it in his target piece for BP about Betances that he's like the 82nd pitcher off the board right now in mixed leagues. Last year, he was the 28th most valuable pitcher total and a top 80 player out of everyone, hitters or pitchers, a year ago. So there's a ton of value if you know where to look with relievers. I love to get an established guy. Speaking generally, I know I'm rambling a little bit here, but there's a clear top tier of closers. There's about 5 to 10 guys that you can feel really confident with going into this year, and that's where I want to invest a lot of my budget with closers.
Yeah, and to hit on both of your points, hit on the first point, I definitely agree with you now. I know in labor and in an auction format, Betances and Miller are going for like 7 or 8. I think that's okay and that's fair, but I like to hit on guys like somebody who's almost not getting touched, even in only, or going for a buck or two, is Tony Watson on the Pirates. You know, and he's just a good example of a guy. He's not going to get the saves, but his stuff is really tough to hit. It's hard for hitters to get a read on. He's in a nice park. I like him. You know, he's in a tougher park, but I like Darren O'Day. You know, Zach Britton is ironclad. I don't expect him to falter, but O'Day's another guy the last few years who has just been super consistent. You know, that funky delivery, just really difficult to see where the ball's, you know, coming or where it's going. So, yeah, that's an excellent point. I love those relievers who everybody forgets about. They go for a buck. No one expects the saves. And once in a while, you do wind up with a situation where those guys get saves. You know, we just see it.
The bigger thing is they chew up innings and they really insulate your ratios. And that's something that can be valuable, especially in a roto league down the stretch, where if you're having to roll the dice on starters, those guys can really help you out and keep your ratios from tanking. I mean, I like, there's a lot of guys who, where if you're really paying attention to relievers, I'm probably the best person to have on this, because I my affinity for relievers is pretty well documented at BP. But if you know where to look, there's some guys whose skills have changed a little bit, and they're in the mold of an O'Day and a Watson, where they're middle relievers in name, but the skills are really elite. And that's a guy who stands out to me is Liam Hendricks. Really fantastic pinpoint control. The velocity spiked. He gained about 3 miles an hour of average velocity last year moving to the Toronto bullpen. He got traded to Oakland. And, Mike, you know who's their closer right now?
Their closer, you know, it's funny you mentioned this, because they were talking about this on ESPN Fantasy Focus today, and they neglected to mention Hendricks.
Yeah.
their closer's Sean Doolittle, and they have proven names in Ryan Madsen, who, I mean, they did sign to a big deal, and John Axford, but I agree, in terms of skills, Hendricks is the guy I would look to replace Doolittle, not those veteran relievers.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even that. I mean, what's the biggest variable that links all of them together? It's health and injury issues. I mean, there are some huge question marks there with those guys, and Hendricks, he's a guy who could emerge there that you can get for nothing in a draft.
I think he went for like a buck in, or two in like each CBS and labor, and he'll probably go for a buck or two in tout. He's not going, and in the mixed leagues, he's just going nowhere. You can get him for a reserve pick.
Yeah, I mean, two other guys who stand out to me, and they're good insurance policies too. If you own Craig Kimbrell or Wade Davis, make sure you get Kelvin Herrera or Carson Smith. I think those guys are really fantastic as well. They're young. They throw hard. Smith's got a weird arm slot, really deceptive. He's going to have a big year for the Red Sox. I'm excited about those two guys. So I think there's a ton of value. Like, instead of, for example, throwing a dart at David Hernandez, I'd rather get a guy who I know is going to at least be solid ratio-wise and put up stellar numbers and maybe has a chance to get some saves as opposed to taking a risk.
Well, two things. The another guy to mention who I like is Tony Zitch in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked a lot, and I know your disdain for Steve Cishek, and I agree with you. And Joaquin Benoit or Benoit is the guy who everyone's looking at, and I think that's fair. But Zitch, you know, he's one of those players who just kind of came out of nowhere. They fixed a flaw in his delivery. I think it was Jeff Sullivan at Fangraphs had a terrific piece about Zitch. But mm-hmm. you know, he's another one. He's just not getting touch in these leagues. I think he went for reserve and labor, and given what, if Cishek doesn't bounce back, try saying that three times fast.
No.
He could be the closer. I did want to ask you, though. I agree about Hernandez and throwing a dart at him. But who's the guy in Philadelphia if it's not Hernandez? Like, is there anybody in that bullpen that you're like, yeah, it's definitely him, or are they all darts?
Oh, man, I can't remember the name of the guy. They had someone. I can't remember his name. Matt Winkleman had it. I can't remember who it was. If I had the depth chart up. Once again, like, did anyone foresee Ken Giles coming up from Double A 2 years ago to be an impact reliever? No. So, I mean, you just never know with some of these situations. But a guy like Steve Cishek, I mean, I can't even put it nicely. I mean, the control is terrible. He walked nearly 5 batters per 9 last year, and his DRA was 4.71. Like, what is the upside there? It's just, it's non-existent. I just would rather pass on a guy like that and take somebody else. It's just not worth the headache. But I think the top of the position is really, really good.
Yeah, it is without a doubt. And, you know, Wade Davis is an example. Kenley Jansen is an example. Aroldis Chapman, when he does come back from that suspension, they're elite relievers, and as you pointed out, they offer so much, not just in strikeouts and saves, but in ERA and whip as well.
The guy who really savvy fantasy owners, I think, are starting to catch on with is Zach Britton. He's been just fantastic over the last couple of seasons. The ground ball rate last year was over 80%. In the last 2 years, which is a span of... he has a 1.77 ERA. That's over 135 appearances with a 141-37 strikeout to walk ratio. I don't think people recognize that. This is a guy with elite skills. He does not give up home runs. He's got that huge ground ball rate. He's outside of that top 4 or 5. He's the next safe guy for me when I really look at the position as a whole. And I don't think he's getting drafted that way right now.
Yeah, I think I noted this when we talked about labor, that the weirdest thing to me about relievers, and I said this to Steve too when we talked about labor, I would have expected a price adjustment at the top for the premier relievers because the bottom is just crap. But it's kind of the opposite. These relievers are going under where they went last year in NFBC drafts, and I don't quite understand it. I think part of it is because the starting pitchers look better. You know, people want to get an ace. People want to lock into those 200 strikeouts. And there's nothing wrong with that by any means. But I really do like the idea, and this ties back to the skill over role. You know, forget the saves that Wade Davis can put up. You look at the other numbers.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, and I just love the idea of getting a guy who could put up a, you know, forget what he did last year. He puts up a 1.7 and a 0.9 and strikes out the guys he can strike out. you're just getting – you're locking in so much security in those categories for your team.
Yeah, and that's the argument for a guy like Betances or Andrew Miller too, is that they're guys who can strike out over 100 batters, and they're providing bulletproof ratios that you're just not going to get from a middle-of-the-road starter or a back-end closer. I mean, once you get outside – if you look at the ADPs right now, once you get outside the top 12 you start to get into guys where there are skills questions. I mean, Brad Boxberger, command issues, Houston Street, I mean, Jonathan Papelbon. I mean, there's some questions there. Sean Tolleson, Santiago Casilla. Glenn Perkins was hurt at the end of last year and was just abysmal in the second half. I mean, there are serious question marks with skills and role where I think you have a chance to just take a bath completely on some of these guys where you're just not going to get anything back.
I completely agree, and that's the risk is that if you spend 13 to 15 on someone like Perkins or Boxberger, and you get nothing, mm-hmm. you know, or if you spend that pick there, if you spend like an 11th or 12th round pick in a 15 team mix, and you get nothing, that's value you're just throwing away that you could have put somewhere else. And you're right, I would prefer. In an auction format, I'd prefer the $2 to $3 reliever like Watson with the skills, or in a draft, I would prefer to just wait. You know, and you can get a guy like that in the 22nd or 23rd round, if not in reserve.
Yeah, I'd love to go. If you could go Wade Davis, Tony Watson, I'd rather have that than Jonathan Papelbon and Sean Doolittle, for example.
That's what we did in labor. We took right. Davis and Andrew Miller, and that was before the Chapman news, granted. So, you know, we did get a bargain because of that, but I honestly didn't. We didn't take Miller because we thought Chapman would get suspended or get a big suspension. We just took him because we're like, well, even if he only saves 3 to 5 games when Chapman can't go, it doesn't matter. He's just a valuable pitcher to have.
Yeah. So I think we've hit on most of the points with relievers.
Yeah.
That's good stuff. We're on the same page with the relief pitchers. That's good to hear.
Yeah. So we have a couple of questions, and I want to get to these. So the first one is, and by the way, if you have questions, you can send them to us at flagsflyforever, all one word, at baseballperspectives.com. So the first one's from John. It reads, "Hey guys, do you have any tips for creating your own rankings? I listened to your podcast about the labor draft and found it interesting when you said you didn't really have any arguments over players. I have played fantasy baseball for many years, but always just used others' rankings. I just started moving players around on a spreadsheet, but I found I am only moving them up or down haphazardly. Any help would be greatly appreciated."
Oh, boy. Well,
yeah.
You're the valuations guy.
Well,
I can give my journal take, but you're the guy to ask.
Well, I'll ask for your take too, George, but what I tend to do, regardless of whether it's an auction or a draft, and John's question is about drafts, I tend to start out trying to rank players without looking at NFBC or another website or Baseball Prospectus or the PFM, and just starting out by feel. And then after I do that, I'll go and look at the published rankings and kind of see where I might be far off. Now, because I've been doing this for so long, 90% of the time my rankings are pretty uniform anyway. The other thing I do is I start out, and this is a little bit different than other people do, I start out looking at the prior year. One of the traps we can fall into looking at projections is already forgetting what the player actually did and what his skill set is and what some of his other numbers look like. It's very important to me, at least, to know what that player actually has done as opposed to what he can do. It's kind of a retrospective analysis as opposed to prospective. As far as the other part of that of moving players around, I like to start out with some solid rankings to begin with, and I'm fairly conservative about moving players around. Injuries or news from camp are the one situation where I'll do that. The other thing that I do, and this kind of ties back to what I said about NFBC rankings and a reality check, is once these expert auctions and drafts get underway, if I see the needle moving on somebody who I really like or I'm really down on because I respect the opinions of a lot of these people, I'll move a player up or down. But you're right, John. To your point, you want to be careful about not just having it be arbitrary. You do want to have a method. And so thanks for your question, John. That was a really good discussion on rankings. The other question is from Davin. Hey guys, I was wondering if there is some advantage to be gained by having so many NL teams rebuilding. Brewers, Reds, Braves, Philly, Rockies, and to lesser degree, Padres and Marlins. Should we go after hitters who face them more? Should we add a buck or two to weak teams' good starting pitchers, knowing they will face other weak teams? Could weaker starting pitchers on good teams get more wins? Gotta be a way to exploit for those of us in deep leagues. Thanks, Davin. So, George, since I started the first one, I'll let you kick this one off.
Well, I think there's one obvious example of a guy you can kind of bump up a little bit based on how bad the division is, but I think that's Max Scherzer. And if you want to do the same thing with the Mets' big three, I'd feel confident doing that. I think there are going to be enough favorable matchups on that schedule where I'd give them a slight boost in terms of like a tiebreaker if I had a bunch of guys similar in my rankings there up at the top of the pitching tiers. That's really, I think, the one area. I think what he's talking about is maybe it has more of a daily fantasy angle to me, where I think you can get some real nice hitter stacks going up against some of the weaker pitchers going out for some of the six teams that are rebuilding in the NL. So I don't know if it's a strategy you can bank on in like a redraft rotisserie league where you're going, well, Justin Bour is going to face weaker pitching throughout the year, so I'm going to throw an extra $2 on him. You know, I don't think that's something you'll know going into the year other than those elite ace-level guys. At least that's the way I see it.
Yeah, and I think I agree with all of that or almost all of that. The paradox here is the deeper the league, the harder it is to make those adjustments.
Yeah.
If you want to add a dollar to Syndergaard because he's in the NL East and the hitters are weaker, that's fine. But honestly, a lot of that is already kind of baked into his projection and baked into the bid or the draft slot with him. So you're kind of seeing that already. I look at where Syndergaard or where Harvey's going. It doesn't make sense to me to say, okay, these guys are in the NL East, I'm going to bump them up, because a big portion of this is that a lot of the rebuilding that's going on is in the National League. I believe every American League team, or just about every American League team, is competitive, or, you know, the worst team looks like a 70 to 75 win team, whereas the worst teams in the National League look like a 100 loss team.
I mean, by Pecota, what is it? The Orioles are the worst projected team in the AL? I mean, they're not terrible.
Yeah, that was probably before, you know, some of the signings, but right there, you know, it's probably the Orioles or the Mariners or
the A's.
One of those teams that's like a 72-75 win team, but still could be competitive, and if a couple breaks go their way, it could still be good. But yeah, getting back on track, so in a mixed league, there's probably two ways to take advantage of this, and the paradox is I don't think it's in a deep league. I think it's in what you mentioned, George, with DFS, but also in leagues that are shallower, like ESPN leagues with daily moves and daily lineup changes. You know, that's where you really want to be on your toes and try to capitalize. So if you're in a 12-team mixed league with unlimited moves and, you know, you can slot guys in and out, and it's a robust free agent pool, you know, by all means, like if Bartolo Colon is sitting out there and Zach Wheeler hasn't come back yet and you need a start – and you haven't hit your start limit, well, you know, you don't think you're close to it, well, by all means, you know, throw them up there against the Braves if you're just looking for volume. But it's really difficult in a seasonal league to kind of say, okay, well, I'm going to value, you know, I mentioned Harvey already, but I'm going to value Max Scherzer way more, or value him so close to Clayton Kershaw because the NL East is weak. You know, Kershaw's still Kershaw. Scherzer might be a little bit closer, but I'm going to take Kershaw. I'm sure anybody would. So, yeah, it's kind of hard to, you know. Another thing too, I made this point like a few years ago. We kind of get a little overly hopped up on these changes. George, you remember when Joey Votto it was Albert Pujols and Prince Fielder both left the National League the same year.
Yep.
And there were all of these NL-only owners that were like, oh, my God, the landscape has changed. I'm going to have to pay really big money for the top hitters. It's going to be crazy. And I did an analysis, a valuation analysis, and what I found was that if you took those two players out of the league and replaced them with nobody, like just no stats at all, the top hitters would have moved up by a buck or two. Mm-hmm. And that assumes no replacements. Somebody's going to come in and replace those guys. And it's you know, we're talking about a little bit more widespread this year, but somebody is going to come in and replace these players that went to the American League. You know, somebody is going to put up some kind of statistics. So
also, that's not even factoring in like prospects who are coming up and making debuts. Like this year, I mean, Corey Seager coming in the National League. Like, there's just an influx every year of hitters who either come up from the minor leagues that are highly touted prospects, or guys who emerge out of nowhere, like Rule 5 guys like Odubel Herrera, that you just don't see coming.
That's precisely it, is that in a macro, when you look at this on a macro level, there's going to be some impact. But what I would say about someone like Paul Goldschmidt, for example, if you were going to bid 40 on him before this, you might bid 42 now, maybe. You know, you might go a little bit higher on him. But you don't want to bid 50 on Paul Goldschmidt because the league's so weak, because you still need to fill out a team. And when you're doing a draft ranking, if it's a draft, you don't want to move somebody up two or three rounds because the division's weak, because it's still going to be a bad buy.
Yep, I agree.
All right, well, again, thanks for your question. And we definitely appreciate all of your questions. And I kind of said the, you know, email already, so I don't necessarily think that I need to do so again. So we're going to take another break, and we'll be right back. We're back, and thank you very much for listening to episode 81 of Flags Fly Forever. This has been a Baseball Prospectus Fantasy podcast. You can read us at baseballprospectus.com. Coming up next week, we have a couple of special events on tap. We have a special valuation podcast coming up, in which neither Brett nor I will be there. We'll be George and our very own Jeff Quinton talking about valuation. We also might drop a live Tout Wars podcast. It won't be live to you, but it'll be something we'll just kind of talk about Tout Wars during Tout Wars weekend, which is coming up March 18th through March 20th. And this week, as I mentioned before, we're wrapping up our positional coverage with relievers. Next week, we'll be a couple weeks gearing up to the regular season. We're almost there. I bet you can feel it. Thank you very much for listening. This is Mike Gianella, and with me has been George Bissell. And once again, thanks to Steve Garner of USA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Good night.